You know what that means?
No idea.
I have no idea. it says, among other things, I got to talk about you. Writer, journalist, social and political commentator. I got a whole long things of what he is, but if you don't know P.J. O'Rourke, why are you here? He is, to me, I know all the Atlantic Monthly and Rolling Stone and all that, but to me, he is always the National Lampoon guy. From the famous cover that I will never forget, "If you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog." And to the wonderful high school yearbook. Any of you remember the high school yearbook that they did? Absolutely one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Nothing has topped it. He is a gentleman who has gone from Ohio now to somewhere in New Hampshire, avoiding all the big cities. You don't like to live in the big cities. We know
taxes. Taxes is actually what I'm avoiding.
Texas is what
Texas. I suppose Texas, too.
Texas and taxes are two things to avoid. Yeah. He has three kids, if I recall, 16, 13, and
10.
And 10.
Yeah.
And the 16 and the 13-year-old are two girls. And I have two girls, 23 and 25. Who is he in for it? I have already gotten to the point now where all of a sudden, maybe I'm not totally stupid, but I'm still
I'm at the totally stupid.
Are you really?
Yeah. Especially with a 16-year-old. Yeah.
His new book is The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and it wasn't my fault, and I'll never do it again. And to me, when you talk about the baby boomers, we do have an influence on life, don't we, PJ?
I'm afraid that we do, for good or for ill.
For good or for ill, you're going to define whether we did good or whether we did bad.
A little bit of both.
The only thing I'm going to try and listen to you, but I'm so self-absorbed as part of
self-absorption
being involved.
The problem with talking to baby boomers, I'm thinking, but what about me?
You got baby boomers. The opposite of talking is not listening; it's waiting to talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, PJ O'Rourke.
Thank you. Somebody has got to tell the Commonwealth Club that the entire purpose of a podium is in case the speaker forgot to zip. This does not work at all. So anyway, I did this book about the baby boom, which is about me, because that's the baby boom way. We are the generation that changed everything. Of all the eras and the epochs of Americans, ours is the one that made the biggest impression on ourselves. But that's an important accomplishment because we are the generation that created the self, made the firmament of the self, divided the light of the self from the darkness of the self and said, let there be self, If you were born between 1946 and 1964, you may have noticed this yourself, And this is not to say we're a selfish generation, because dictionary definition of selfish is too concerned with the self. And self isn't something that we're just like, concerned with, We are self. We are self. Before us, self was without form and void, like our parents in their dumpy clothes and vague ideas, And then we came along. And now the personal is the political, the personal is the socioeconomic, the personal is the religious and the secular, the science and the arts. The personal is everything that creepeth upon the earth after his, and let us hasten to add her, kind. If the baby boom has done one thing, it is to beget a personal universe. And our apologies to anyone who personally happened to turn out to be a jerk. Because you see, self is like fish, proverbially speaking. Give a man a fish, you've fed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, and if he turns into a dry fly, catch and release, angling fanatic, up to his liver in icy water, pestering trout with a 3-pound test line on a $1,000 graphite rod, well, at least his life partner is glad to have him out of the house. So here we are in the baby boom cosmos, formed in our image, personally tailored to our individual needs, and predetermined to be eternally fresh and novel, and we saw that it was good, or pretty good. We should have had a cooler name. We really should. Like the Lost Generation. We should have, I mean, good luck to anybody who tries to tell us to get lost, but we should have had a cooler name. Too late now. We're stuck with being described as exploding infants. And maybe it's time, now that we have splattered ourselves all over the place, for the baby boom to look back and think, what made us who we are, what caused us to act the way we do, and what the fuck? You know? Because the truth is, if we hadn't decided to be young forever, we would be old. The youngest baby boomers, born in the last year when anybody thought it was hip to like Lyndon Johnson, the youngest baby boomers are turning 50 this year, 2014. We'd be sad about getting old if we weren't too busy remarrying younger wives, reviving careers that hit glass ceilings when children arrived, and renewing prescriptions for drugs that keep us from being sad. And we'll never retire. We can't. The mortgage is underwater. We're in debt up to the Rogaine for the kids' college education. And this serves us right, because we're the generation who insisted that a passion for living should replace working for one. No. Still, it's an appropriate moment for us to weigh what we have wrought and tally what we have added and subtracted from existence. We've reached the age of accountability. The world is our fault. We are the generation that has an excuse for everything. One of our greatest contributions to modern life, as far as I'm concerned. But the world is still our fault, and it's just a matter of power and privilege demography. Whenever anything happens anywhere, somebody over 50 pays the bill for it, you know? And a baby boom, seated as we are at the head of life's table, is hearing Generation X, Generation Y, and the millennials all saying, check, please, you know? But I have a little problem with this book, trying to talk about the whole baby boom all at once. I mean, to address America's baby boom is to face big, broad problems. We number more than 75 million, and we're diverse. And we're not only are we diverse, but we take a thorny pride in our every deviation from the norm, even though we're in therapy for it. We are all alike in thinking that each of us is unusual, you know? And unfortunately, we actually are all alike in our approach to big, broad problems. We won't face them. there is a website for that, a support group to join, a class to take, alternative medicine, regular exercise, a book that explains it all, a celebrity on TV who's been through the same thing, or we can eliminate gluten from our diet. You know, history is full of generations that had too many problems. We are the first generation to have too many answers, which is not a problem, not a problem. Consider the people who have faced up squarely to the deepest and most perplexing conundrums of existence. I give you, for example, Leo Tolstoy. He tackled every one of the conundrums of existence. Why are we here? What kind of life should we lead? The nature of evil, the character of love, the essence of identity, salvation, suffering, death. And what did this get him? Dead, for one thing, you know, and off his rocker for the last 30 years of his life, for another. Plus, Tolstoy was saddled with this 1,000-page novel about war and peace and everything else you can think of, and he couldn't even look it up on Wikipedia because he hadn't written it yet. You know, I mean, what a life, you know? If Leo Tolstoy had been a baby boomer, he could have entered a triathlon, which was a baby boom innovation from the middle 1970s. You know, by the middle 1970s, we knew we couldn't run away from our problems. But if we added cycling and swimming. So, to the problems of talking about the baby boom, let us turn our big, broad, yet soon to be firmed up, thanks to the triathlon for seniors that we're planning to enter, generational backsides. However, another difficulty remains. Most groups of people who get tagged by history as a generation, they can really be described in an easy kind of offhand way. I mean, they're folks sort of the same age, experiencing sort of the same thing, in sort of the same places. You know, it's like the cast of Seinfeld or Cheers, you know. I myself, as a result of having taken modern literature in college, I'm almost sure that Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, Henry Miller, and Ezra Pound were roommates in a big apartment on the Left Bank in Paris in the 1920s. You know? If that turns out not to be true, I give it the idea for free to you audience members for a possible sitcom, which I think would work. But unlike most generations, the baby boom has actually an exact demographic definition. We're the children who were born during a period after World War II when the long-term trend in fertility among American women was exceeded. Now, this excess began promptly in 1946 when the guys got home from overseas, and it gradually tapered off until by 1964, women were taking the pill or rolling over and pretending to go to be asleep, you know, or telling their husbands, go phone the Pope and ask him where to buy rubbers or something at any rate. So 46 to 64, this is a long time. And, you know, making distinctions among all these baby boomers, 75 million baby boomers born over this long period of time, it's hard to make distinctions. I mean, geographical distinctions don't really work because we moved around too much, you know. And distinctions according to race or class or gender or sexual orientation would be offensive to baby boom sensitivities. And furthermore, for me, they would be just totally beside the point because, you know, as much as I want, really want to be as different from everyone else in the world as a member of the baby boom is supposed to be, I'm not. I happen to be hopelessly ordinary in matters of race, class, gender identification, which section of Playboy I turned to first when I was 16. You know, I'm from Toledo, Ohio. You know, I'm middle-income family, the whole thing. So I was trying to figure out a way to sort the baby boom, and I decided that, well, we're the generation that never grew up, and high school classes probably is the best way to explain us is in terms of high school classes. And the senior class of the baby boom, to which I belong, we were born in the late 40s, and we were on the bow wave of the baby boom voyage of exploration. And yet at the same time, born so soon after the war, we were very closely tethered to the greatest generation, to the generation of our parents. And so the senior class of the baby boom ended up getting sort of keel-hauled, you know, dragged under the hull. And we wound up, you know, a little bit soggy and shaken from the experience. And you know, if we turned out to be financial advisors trying to wear tongue studs or Trotskyites trying to organize Tea Party protests or both, you know, I mean, I think we are to be forgiven. I think if I'm going to sum up the senior class of the baby boom, I would say simply that Hillary Clinton and Cheech of Cheech and Chong both belong to the senior class. If you average them, you get, you know, us, you know. Now, the junior class of the baby boom, they were born in the early 50s. They were younger siblings of senior class members. And what happened with the junior class members is they came of age when parents were just throwing in the towel. You know, parents were just giving up on that, you know, that dinner time shouting match, you know. And so the junior class ended up pursuing the notions and the whims and the fancies of the baby boom with an even greater intensity than the senior class of the baby boom. I mean, for the juniors, you know, drugs were no longer experimental. Drugs were proven, you know. John Belushi was a member of the baby boom junior class. John was born in 1949, but I knew John, and I'm pretty sure he was held back a couple of years. So I think he counts as a member of the junior class. You see, the junior class, they were the teeny boppers. They were the groupies. They were the barefoot urchins over here in Haight-Ashbury, you know. Now, they hunted up some shoes when they eventually made their way to Silicon Valley. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs were both born in 1955. They never did find their neckties, you may have noticed. Now the sophomore class is a little different. They're born in the late 1950s. Now, by the time the sophomore class reaches adolescence, the baby boom ethos has pretty well permeated society. And so the sophomores, they gladly accepted sex, drugs, and rock and roll and the deep philosophical underpinnings thereof. But they'd also seen enough of the older baby boom in action to realize that what works in general terms doesn't always work when the bong sets fire to the beanbag chair. You know, so some of the sophomore class of the baby boom, some of them when they were in college actually attended classes. You know, some even sneaked off and got MBAs. You know, now the freshmen are to me are the most interesting of all among other reasons. The fact that our president of the United States is a member of the baby boom freshman class. Now the freshmen. For the freshmen, the whole baby boom world was just a given. They knew of no other world. They felt no visceral effects from the events that formed the baby boom. I mean, to the freshmen, the Vietnam War, if they remember it at all, was just something that was inexplicably on TV all the time, like Ed McMahon. You know, feminism had gone from a pressing social issue to Maude, you know, a TV comedy show that their parents liked. You know, Martin Luther King was a day off from work. You know, they didn't feel any of these things happening. They just assumed that this is the way the world was. And my favorite example of that was didn't even rise to scandal, but the sort of kerfluffle. You may remember from President Obama was running for his first term, the Reverend Wright. Reverend Wright. Remember Reverend Wright? Reverend Wright was a man of, how shall we put it, forceful views. Forcefully put. You know? God damn America, you know, and how the CIA invented AIDS to kill black people and so on and so forth. And so, you know, the right, the Republicans, Fox News, just jumped on this. I mean, here's the pastor of Michelle and Barack Obama's church. He married them. He christened their children. And so the right is just going nuts. This guy's a maniac. You know, I mean, what is going on? And yet that scandal never really took hold. It never really got anywhere in the public imagination because we're baby boomers and we knew that President Obama wasn't listening to any of this. He was sitting in the back pew blackberrying with Rahm Emanuel, you know? And as for all this stuff that's coming from the pulpit, it's like, well, wasn't the world always full of bullshit? You know, I mean, of course, that's the way everybody talks, you know? And so, well, now the American baby boom, I say it's the world's future. I say it's the world's future. I say everyone on this planet is going to turn into the American baby boom eventually. It may take years, it may take decades, it may even take centuries. But eventually, families are going to get too prosperous, too happy, start feeling too much love for their kids, being too permissive with their children. And now, I might be wrong. This might not work out because, you know, the baby boom style, extravagant freedom and scant responsibility and plenty of money and a modicum of peace, that might lead to such a high rate of carbon emissions that we all fry or drown. I've lost track about whether we're supposed to fry or drown. You know, it's like global warming. You know, then it got cold this winter and it's become climate change. I'm behind the times on all this. But anyway. So we may all die, but you can't have everything. And you can have a profusion of opportunity and at the same time a collapse of traditional social standards. And if you look at Western Europe, if you look at the wealthiest parts of Asia and Latin America, you see us, you see the baby boom. They are almost as useless as we are, meaning useless in the best sense of the word, you know, with abundant disposable income and ample leisure time to devote to pointless activities like pestering trout and things that basically don't harm anybody much except themselves. And another interesting point to me is how these baby boom-like places around the world, they all seem to be engaged in the same sort of political deadlock that we have here in the United States. Now, a lot of pundits do a lot of tut-tutting about national political deadlock. And I think about national political deadlock and I go, well, the Germany wasn't deadlocked when they marched into Poland in 1939, were they? Japan wasn't in political deadlock when they bombed Pearl Harbor, you know. There are worse things out there than political deadlock. I give you, for instance, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, you know, that let LBJ do anything that he wanted in the war in Vietnam, and we all know how well that turned out, you know. You know that in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, there were two votes against it in the Senate and none in the House. So when we wish for bipartisan cooperation, let us be very careful what we wish for, you know. Anyway, excuse me, I have a little cough. If you have been investigating the new legalization policies in Colorado and Washington State as heavily as I have, it takes a certain toll. But, you know, I think that truly noxious politics are going to go away because, frankly, we're too self-centered to all get dressed up in the same brown shirt and make the same salute at the same time. We're too self-centered to have a Bolshevik revolution or even a cultural revolution in China. And that's not a bad thing, you know. And stupid notions of central planning, nationalization, protectionist trade barriers, these are going to fall by the wayside because everybody will have been asleep in Econ 101, just like I was, you know. So we don't know enough. One of the reasons that the world has had such great economic success and, under the baby boom leadership is that we don't know anything about it. We are all asleep in Econ 101. You know, and you know that there are 1.3 billion people in the United States who are living on less than a dollar and a quarter a day. You know, the way I once was when I was selling pot that smoked all the profits. And those 1.3 billion people, they're going to figure out that there is a better way. I just received an email from Nigeria about a rather large amount of money needing to be transferred to an American bank with requiring only modest assistance on my part. There will be no religious fanaticism in the baby boom world of the future because we're not a generation who listens to anybody, God included, you know. and you know, I don't think God minds. I really don't think God minds. He doesn't mind about us not bothering with him because very few of the people whom we've bothered, parents, college deans, the police, LBJ, attractive types in bars, very few of them have minded when we quit bothering them. You know, so world peace, probably too much to ask. But we're never going to be able to assemble those enormous conscripted armies that fought those horrible wars like World War I and World War II and India and Korea and Vietnam because we're all going to have a letter from our doctor about how we're allergic to camouflage. You know, I mean, it's just not going to happen. Besides, war is about power. And one thing, there are many things that can be said in criticism of the baby boom, but baby boomers are not power hungry because power comes with that kicker responsibility. You know, now we're greedy. We're greedy. We're greedy for love. We're greedy for happiness. We're greedy for experience, for sensation, for thrills, for praise, fame, adulation, inner peace, and, as it turns out, money, health and fitness too. But we're not greedy for power, you know. I can prove this to you. I can prove this to you. Look at the members of the baby boom who have ascended to political power in Washington, D.C., and there's many, many of them. We've reached the age where the government is essentially a baby boom enterprise. Look at those baby boomers in Washington, D.C., and ask yourself, best and brightest? I don't think so. I don't think so. Best and brightest are over at Goldman Sachs. So I have this kind of prediction, a kind of rant at the world's tyrannical and despotic, horrible dictators and authoritarian forces all around the world. And it's in the two-bit countries that they run. And I say to all these people, from Putin, you know, to the Chinese Politburo, to the horrible dictators in Africa, to all of them, I say, you shall turn into baby boomers too. It shall rain on your Woodstock. You shall spend your treasure on disco, cocaine, and rehab. Your junk bonds shall default, and your dot-com bubble shall burst. You shall form overage garage bands and try to play Margaritaville. Your third spouse shall acquire an American Express Black Card with a credit limit higher than the U.S. national debt. Your daughters shall wear nose rings. Your sons shall have pagan symbols indelibly marked upon their necks. Unless, of course, you belong to one of those cultures where daughters wear nose rings and sons have pagan symbols indelibly marked upon their necks, in which case they shall not. You shall be perplexed by the Internet. You shall grow old and addled enough to vote for Ross Perot in a presidential primary. Because there's no escape from happiness, no escape from attention, no escape from affection, no escape from freedom, from irresponsibility, from money, peace, opportunity, and from deciding that everything that happens and that you've ever heard is all bullshit. You know? And so I say to the tyrants of the world, I say, behold the baby boom, ye mighty, and despair. Okay, that's everything I know. If people have questions, I will make up some other stuff. Okay? But...
We've got a lot of questions from the audience, but you know I'm going to start. Me generation.
Yeah, come on, go. Yeah,
you
talk
about the best and the brightest, and that made me laugh, too, when you think that, you know, go back when we started this country, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, people like that. And now we're at a point where the top two people are Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. You know what we learned from that? Darwin was wrong.
Darwin was wrong. Devo was right.
Yeah. on a serious side, though, remember when we were growing up, it was, boy, wait till we get political power. Everything is going to change. We're going to do it. And so you think, okay, we'll elect somebody who was the head of the shrooms. He didn't just smoke weed. He always got the last toke. And we'll put him in the White House. And if we do that, everything will change.
Yeah, yeah.
It hasn't happened. Why?
No. You expect at least the drones to have paisley paint, you know, spray painted on them or something. Well, we discovered, in our wonderful self-centered way, we discovered that politics is this professional field, well-rewarded, with prestige, if not with money, and usually you end up making a lot of money, too. Very well-rewarded professional field, prestigious, with no entry barriers to it. There's no test, obviously no IQ test. There's no test, there's no demonstration of skills, there's no board that you certification that you have to get. There's no bar exam to take, you know. To go into politics requires absolutely nothing but a mastery of bullshit, which our generation is famous for. And so boom, we just rushed right into this, you know. And a lot of people say, oh, you know, Washington is, you know, it's hopelessly deadlocked, it's hopelessly polarized. I said, no, we just like to yell at each other, you know. I mean, we just enjoy this, you know. And of course, we don't, as it turns out, have any politics. Now, back in the 60s, you might have thought, this is a generation that has a political point of view. And when they come into power, we are going to see that political point of view. Well, no, it does. It turns out we don't. And we've had three baby boom presidents so far, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. You map these guys out politically, you'd have to go to Pyongyang to find three people that were more different, you know, somebody that's more different than these three people. We don't have a particular political view. We just love politics because it's easy. You know?
How do you think we did as parents?
I think we did pretty well as parents. You know, we didn't do too well in it staying together as parents. But I'm impressed by the generations that have come after the baby boom. They seem to have taken away a lot of the good qualities of the baby boom, which is a go-along, get-along, happy generation, generation that's a lot of fun, generation that wants to give the world a hug and a drug. You know, we want to be loved. We want everybody to love us. You know, we want to love everybody. They've taken that part of it, and they've kind of left some of the excesses. I always think of the baby boomers. We were basically the guinea pig generation. Somebody had to try all the sex and drugs in the world, you know, and to see whether this was healthy, which it wasn't. But, you know, the experiment's been done, you know, and the kids today can look at that and say, not so much so. You know?
Give you an off-the-wall question. What do you think we'd have been like if we had smartphones the way we have now? How would we have been
different?
What would
we be like if we had had smartphones? I just don't think we would have used them much because it's just not fun to yell at people from a distance, you know. We like to yell at people up front, you know. I mean, we just like to argue and interact. We're a very personal generation. We are, you know, touchy-feely, not always in a good way, you know. But you know, I don't think this whole stuff would have gone. And the whole idea that your parents could get a hold of you at any time in any place. Come on! You kidding me? You know, and they can put this thing on your phone that tracks where you are. You know, I don't think so. You know, I think the smartphone would have gone right out the car window. You know, while we were cruising a burger stand. You know?
Wait a minute, you got a 16-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 10-year-old.
Yeah,
and you haven't mastered, Daddy. The problem is the battery ran out.
Oh yeah.
So no, you're not available all the time.
I do hear that quite a bit. You know, and I choose to believe them because, you know, thinking back, you know, the hovering parents. I can't remember who told me this because this is not my line. I'd like to give credit where credit is due. But they said that the baby boom, we're the helicopter parents. Our parents, the greatest generation, they were the drone parents, you know, much farther away. And every now and then, whack. Whereas we're right there, you know, right on top of everybody doing their homework, you know, and making out their college applications and all the rest of the stuff.
One of the defining things when you think of us as parents, and this is like an official entry, then you know you're a baby boomer, when you have a son or a daughter and they have their first experience with weed, and here you are, you grew up with this all your life, and now it's your kid, and everybody says, every parent says the same thing, but it's not as strong, it wasn't anywhere near as strong as it is now. You got to be real careful. Everybody says the same thing on that. I got some good questions here.
Although I don't. I lie.
You lie?
I lie. Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine when my kids were a little younger and his kids were around the age of my kids. I said, well, you know, it's time you got to talk to him about drugs. What are you going to say to him? And he says, I lie. Daddy never did drugs. Drugs are terrible. That picture of Daddy was hair all over the place. It was our band played a lot of folk masses. And I said, you lie. You lie about this. You've written about doing drugs. And he said, the one person that you can count on, only person in the world you can count on to never, ever read a single word you've written is your kid. Care less, you know.
Same thing when it comes to listening to the radio.
Exactly.
All right, now this is a good question from the audience, although I'll answer it right away.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, I'll give you the answer, then the question.
Yeah.
Probably the answer is because we're too lazy and we're older and standing is a little more difficult. But the question is, why aren't people protesting like they did before?
Yeah, well, okay. Let's take the war in Vietnam, which began, you know, functionally began in the 60s, the fairly early 60s. Began probably in earnest in about 1964. Didn't end for... And we went out and we protested the living hell out. You couldn't protest much more than we protested that. And that worked, didn't it? Thing only went on for a decade. You know, we brought that thing right to a stop. So I think people now realize that there are limits to what you can do with protesting. I think it was Occupy Wall Street was sort of sweet, but it was basically, we are going to stay right here until there is peace and justice and equality in America, or until it gets really cold. Which And so, I think people are just, more sensible about the limitations of... And the thing is that the protest only works when you have a really undeniable moral question on your side. It works for something like civil rights, It works, it conceivably would work for something like gay rights. But it doesn't really work on murky questions of income distribution and so on and so forth. And it works very slowly. Let us not forget how slow, how long the civil rights battle lasted. I mean, arguably it lasted about 250 years, didn't it? I think people are just a little more time efficient.
Maybe that's it. Here's another one from the audience. What impact has the baby boomer generation had on Gen Y, people in their 30s, and the millennials?
Well, I think we kind of answered that earlier. We raised them, yeah. Yeah, we raised them, and they've turned out to be surprisingly good kids. Few too many nose rings and tattoos, but, basically really good kids. And, the tattoos, the piercings, I sort of feel like, it's kind of the right, almost the obligation of every generation of adolescents to kind of shock their parents, and be different, There are protests about this kind of thing going all the way back down to ancient Romans. And every generation comes along has to be different. And our generation used up all the different, We used up all the weird. Weird things, we said them, Weird beards, we wore them, Weird stuff, we did it. Weird drugs, we took them, And so our kids wound up in this world with a weird shortage, And so in order to, freak us out a little bit, as every child is, has a divine right to do, they got to pierce themselves. They had to pierce their tongues and, get tattoos all over the place. And, ouch, that must have hurt, and I apologize, but it was...
We'll do one more real quickie. Is that all right? Can I do one more? Yes. Okay. Because you were holding up. Is that 30 seconds or 30 minutes? Oh, I got 20 more minutes to go.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God. I thought this thing went really fast.
Yeah.
Whew. Shouldn't have stopped at that cannabis club thing on the way.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Question for you here. Who, obviously mistaken.
It was medical, though.
Why else?
Yeah, medical. I had a great idea for a bumper sticker. Medical marijuana makes me sick.
Well, now it's like you go into one of the places to get the card, and they'll say to you, how are you feeling? And you go, pretty good. And they go, no. How are you feeling?
How are you feeling? terrible, persistent headaches.
Here is someone who has mistaken you for Chris Matthews. Says, who will be the GOP nominee for president in 2016, and do they have any chance to win?
too far to foresee. It could be Chris Christie, because you think about this. He's got all these scandals going and all that stuff at the moment. People really going to remember this? And imagine him and Hillary sitting down having the presidential debate, and she's going, I take full responsibility. Benghazi happened on my watch. And Chris Christie going, I take full responsibility. Traffic was terrible on my watch. So it could be him, But I have a feeling that there's younger, faster. There's always somebody younger. No matter how fast you are, there's somebody younger and faster coming up. And I think that's going to happen to Hillary, and I think that's going to happen to most of what we see out there as current possible favorites on the Republican side. I just think, yes.
Is there a shift from the Republican side to the basic point of now it's more libertarian? We all tend to be libertarian, but we won't vote for the Libertarian Party because they're not going to win. But we all have
also
a
they have a
generation
tendency to
a lot
be
of a libertarian philosophy.
The Libertarian Party has a tendency to be insane. A little bit. I say this as a libertarian. I've had years and years of involvement with the Cato Institute, the main libertarian think tank. But frankly, the Libertarian Political Party will find the legalized heroin guy, to get out there in front, and take an issue we can all agree on. That sounds like swell. And to do it, in the soundbite, standing in front of Philip Seymour Hoffman's house, the libertarians will find that person to do that. Yeah, I do think that there's an underlying libertarian tendency across the full span of baby boom politics, from the left to the right. Left tends to concentrate a little bit more on the personal liberties side of this, a little bit more the economic liberties. The right tends to concentrate. But things like NSA really bring us together. That creeps everybody out, you know. And I mean, and it's just, you know, my only reason I even call myself a conservative is not because I'm against any particular thing that the federal government does. It's just quantitative. The thing is just too damn big, you know. And when it does something like NSA, you realize that it is too damn big, and it, you know, it ends up being a law unto itself. And this is a democracy, and we're supposed to make the laws, you know. They're not supposed to make the laws for us. So I think that libertarian tendency we've seen it on some social issues over this past year. Isn't it amazing how fast the public attitude about gay marriage changed? I mean, it's like in a blink of an eye, you know. And legalization of soft drugs, you know. I mean, that is moving at an extremely fast pace. You would think that it would have, you know, that we could have done a little bit more of this. We didn't have to wait till we were 50 to do this.
Well, but maybe changed? We did. How come it's taken this long?
Maybe it is because we're 50. You know, politics is the one field you don't age out of. You know, being 50, being 60 in politics is not a drawback. It's not a weakness. It takes that long to get political power. And maybe some of the libertarian tendencies of our generation are only showing up now that we are of an age to have our hands on the levers of political power.
Here's one for you from Mike, who says, in Give War a Chance, you said you'd gladly let Vietnam vets punch you in the nose. I have no desire to do that.
I'm glad to hear that,
Mike. Can I get half off on the book instead?
Unfortunately, I've talked to the bookstore about that, but I will give you a long and elaborate thing. Yeah, I think one of the shameful things that happened when the baby boom was young was the way, I mean, we were against the Vietnam War, and we were right about being against the Vietnam War, but we sure didn't seem to mind letting the poor kids go fight it, you know. I mean, I went down, this is like 1970, I got drafted. I go down to the draft board, and we're standing there in our socks and underwear. And you could tell by the socks and the underwear who was going and who wasn't, you know. You know, the guys that were standing there in the kind of underwear that you buy in a large bag at Kmart, you know, and you know, and the socks all sort of pilled up and droopy, versus the guys standing there with a gold toe over the calf, you know, and the boxer shorts, you know. And not only that, of course, all the boxer shorts and gold toe over the calf guys has big, thick manila envelope from their doctor under their arm, you know. And so, you know, you could stand there and you could see that it was the poorer kids who were going to go to Vietnam. Not universally true, of course. But it was predominantly true, especially you know of the enlisted men draftees. And did I learn some important lessons standing there at that draft physical? No, I was much too interested in getting out of the Army. You know, and not getting drafted was what was mainly on my mind. It wasn't until years later that I realized how sort of a chilling a divide. And you know, it's still people from modest circumstances who make up the bulk of our armed forces, but they have chosen it, and they're good at it. And I spent years as a war correspondent. I spent like 20 years covering trouble spots from the Civil War in Lebanon to the Iraq War. I covered this stuff. During the Gulf War, I was with some British guys, and there was a British soldier who had been in Vietnam. You know, the Brits did have some presence in Vietnam. He had been a captain medical corpsman in Vietnam, and he had come back. He was getting kind of old, and he'd come back as a volunteer to work with the British Army in the Gulf War. And he said, you know, I've just been over to see your troops, just been over to meet, like, the American troops. And he said, I can't believe this is the same army that I saw in Vietnam. I can't believe they come from the same country as they did in Vietnam. And if you spend time with American servicemen, you can't help but be like awed by their professionalism and their dedication to what their esprit de corps and so on. And this has a lot to do with freedom. It has a lot to do with that freedom of choice.
Also want to mention, this is the Commonwealth of California program. We're talking to P.J. O'Rourke about his new book called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way and Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. I'm Ron Owens, KGO San Francisco radio host. I like that, radio host, and your moderator. Remember, you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see videos of the programs online at your YouTube channel. Here's one that's interesting. Who is the funniest politician in Washington, perhaps in spite of themselves?
Yeah, I was going to say intentional division or unintentional division. Yeah. And really, you know, Rob Ford up in Toronto just pretty much knocked the floor out of everybody. You know? Yeah, I'm not really seeing anybody in Washington who can top him. You know, but the intentionally funny. You know, you'd be surprised at who is very, very funny. It's people like Bob Dole. Mm. Bob Dole has a wicked sense of humor, which he never showed on the campaign trail. Haley Barbour, former governor of Mississippi, is an extremely funny guy. Chris Dodd, the senator from ex-senator from Connecticut, again very funny. Teddy Kennedy was very funny. Barney Frank is not funny. You got Henry Waxman from out here, not funny. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with ideology or party lines or something. It's just like but the old style Pauls, the one that still go out and have drinks with each other. And of course Reagan, when it's very, very high bar to get. I mean, that guy really was funny, and he was funny. I mean, somebody told me. It heard him tell a joke privately, you know, not the kind of thing that the President of the United States said. It was when he was about to have yet another meeting with Gorbachev. And he's talking about a Russian and an American are talking. And the Russian said, I hate Gorbachev. And the American said, I hate Reagan. And the Russian said, the American said, I hate Reagan so much, I pissed on his limousine. And the Russian said, I hate Gorbachev so much I shit on his limousine. And the American says, well, to tell the truth, the president wasn't in the limousine when I pissed on him. And the Russian says, well, to tell the truth, my pants weren't down. That guy was hard to beat.
As we continue with Don Rickles, here's another one. In the 60s, conservatives were erudite and witty like Bill Buckley, and today the Tea Party seems to be the face of the right. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good question, and it's an embarrassing question to somebody who considers himself to be, you know, kind of conservative libertarian. It is a danger when people get over-enthusiastic about things. I mean, I think we see a fair amount of idiocy from the Tea Party. At the root of this, at least with some of them, not all of them, because they, you know, the Tea Party's a big tree, and big trees attract squirrels, and so there are some people up there that, you know, because the Tea Party did not start out having anything to do with social conservatism, and most Tea Party supporters are not particularly social conservatives. But it has gotten that kind of, it's attracted other social conservatives, and that's very worrisome. But, you know, at the root of the Tea Party ethos is a real respect for and concern with the Constitution and the fundamental principles that the Constitution lays down. And that's not a bad thing. Just as, you know, we also saw a lot of and heard a lot of idiotic things from Occupy Wall Street. But at the root of the Occupy Wall Street, at the heart of the Occupy Wall Street ethos, was a feeling of being worried, being upset, being deeply concerned about an increasingly economically divided America, an America that is going through a kind of traumatic period of economic change. Change that in the long run will probably be for the better, but in the short term is going to cause tremendous dislocations, tremendous difficulties, which we are not addressing. And so you see that one of the problems, Tea Party is probably a better, it's a more powerful example than Occupy Wall Street, but you see the worry about amateurism in politics. Much as we are a democracy, much as we are a government of the people, there's still, it is better for politicians to have some level of professionalism, you know? And you see the difference here between John Bonner and Ted Cruz, you know? I mean, John Bonner, like, knows how to, you know, he's outnumbered. He knows how to lose gracefully. He knows how to surrender on something like the debt ceiling limit, where there really was no option except to raise this debt ceiling, which is kind of stupid, because if your house were filling with sewage, would you lower the sewage or would you raise the ceiling? But, you know, nonetheless, for the sake of the full faith and credit of the United States and our credit rating and so on, the debt ceiling had to be raised. And he didn't really see any point in attempting to attach Republican agenda items to this fundamental piece of legislation, because they'd get voted down. They would just get voted down, or they would get vetoed, and we would be back in a government shutdown. And, you know, a government shutdown always sounds tempting, you know, when the government is really annoying you, but it doesn't actually functionally work very well. And so you have a grown-up here, and versus Ted Cruz, who's just not a grown-up, you know. And so there's a lot of not grown-ups out there on both sides in Washington.
Is it a function of being a baby boomer, or is it just age, that as we get older, our attention span seems to go?
You and I were talking about this earlier. There's been some social science research. We all know how accurate social science research always is. Social science, and it's basically the our brains are so full of many things that we know that there sometimes just isn't room for other things, like our cell phone number, our own cell phone number, or our kids' names. I mean, I got 3 kids, I got 4 dogs. I got to run through all 7 before I hit on the one that I want to yell at,
I got 2 kids and 5 dogs, and I'm the lowest on the list. Believe me.
You get fed last.
I get fed last. Here's an obvious one, but a good one. What impact did the Beatles have on the baby boomers?
Oh, yeah, we were just talking about this today because, we're right here with the Ed Sullivan anniversary. And I was 16 and when I was hanging out at my house with some of my 16-year-old guy friends, and we're watching this, and we were really torn about this. You know, people think of this as just like a pure nostalgia, but if you go back and you think about this clearly, the Beatles had great music, or certainly a lot better music than was current on the pop music stations at the time. Beatles did have a little bit of good luck in sort of landing in the United States at a time when our, AM pop music was pretty much at a low ebb, Hey, hey, Paul, hey, Paula, go into the chapel and we're going to get married. It was pretty bad junk. And so we liked their music. But there were all these, screaming 13-year-old girls, surrounding them in this really Justin Bieber embarrassing way. So we were watching this television with, mixed emotions. We liked the act, but the whole, all the this screaming, thing just seemed to us, embarrassing. You can't get more embarrassed than you get at 16. 16 is like the age of maximum embarrassment, And so we just didn't know what to think. We wanted to listen to their music, but we did not want to be part of this Justin Bieber thing. So it was a little bit more, the Beatle arrival was a little bit more complicated than we now tend to remember it in strictly sentimental terms.
When we were going to school, you'd have a project and you'd have to go to the library and you'd have to look things up and then you'd copy things down by hand. And now it's all computerized. Are we better off?
Well, I've been reading my daughter's papers that she has done for school, because she's just about to transfer schools. And one of the things that the new school wanted was some examples of the papers that she'd done. And I'd been reading them anyway, you know, while she was doing her homework. And she, of course, does everything. It is entirely computerized. Whereas, you know, and basically, you know, she's cribbing from Wikipedia. I was cribbing from the Encyclopedia Americana, you know.
But it took longer.
It took longer. It was slower. Yeah, she can crib faster than I can crib. But just enough rephrasing so it's not actually plagiarism. And, yeah, her papers are kind of crap, you know. And my papers were really crap, you know. So I don't really see the difference, you know, for all the difference in appearances in the way they're doing things. The actual output is, it's a high school kid's paper, you know.
I got to ask this one. It's on a napkin.
Oh yeah, good. Yeah, no, written on cocky.
What would Adam Smith think of the debt ceiling? You know him?
Yeah. Not quite that old. Right?
We're not that old
no.
yet.
No, but I did write a book about Adam Smith and about the wealth of nations. And Adam Smith would be deeply puzzled by the modern monetary system. Adam Smith came from a time when it was basically inconceivable to have a monetary system that didn't have some sort of fixed value, gold being the most common, although silver had been used by the Spanish. Indeed, platinum had been used by the Portuguese. But anyway, it was a fixed value. And Smith was critical of this fixed value, of this hard, what we would call hard money today. He was critical of the system. In fact, he was the person that proved that precious metals. There's a 72-page section in The Wealth of Nations, which I recommend that you do not read because it's unbelievably boring, about the fluctuations in the value of silver over time. You imagine the difficulty of the research of this. I mean, this is the day before these kind of statistics were kept. He was writing to people all over Europe in several different languages and stuff to find out, you know, how many loaves of bread so much silver could buy at such and such a time and such a place. And he was one of the people who proved that precious metals are, in fact, commodities, and they do have price spikes and price. But nonetheless, he felt committed to a system of money that had some sort of foundation to it, rather than the kind of like, let's just make it up money, you know, the kind of, you know, Clap and Tinkerbell will stay alive, or Clap and Janet Yellen will stay alive, I guess is actually
So he wouldn't be a Bitcoin fan.
No, I don't think he'd be a Bitcoin fan at all. No, and he actually is a very, very, he posed the idea rather briefly, but to the best of my knowledge, he was the first person to do so, of a market basket, commodity market basket basis for currency value. And he was very, very, he had experienced inflation. There had been a number of attempts to introduce paper money into Europe, and every time that they did it, there was like Weimar Republic scale inflation, and so he was very much against that kind of paper money. So he'd be more mystified by our monetary system than he would be by a lot of our modern inventions, you know, which I think that, you know, he'd figure out, intuit how they worked pretty quickly.
Every generation likes to look at the next one and the one after that and say we're better than that. If there was one basic phrase, if I said those of us in the baby boomer generation, for all of our faults or whatever, seem to have a bigger heart than the millennials today, would you agree? And if so, why?
That I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because they're young. And, you know, there is a certain heartlessness to youth. I don't think you can judge the kind of heart people have until they have grown up, you know, and become parents and become responsible for other people and maybe responsible for their own parents. Too soon to judge from millennials. Millennials are people who are, you know, I mean, you know, they're only like my daughter's age. You know, they were born in the late 90s and the early aughts. And so I wouldn't say that. If I were going to say something good about our generation, I would say that we are fun. We have had a lot of fun. Maybe a little too much fun. Fun's not always pretty. But it's been more fun since we took over. And I put the time, the date of when we took over, pretty exactly. It is when Animal House was released.
Mm-hmm.
1975, 1976, whatever it was. That when Animal House came out, that is when the baby boom really sort of took over America. And my proof of that is Senator Blutarsky. If you go to Washington, he is everywhere. You know, Senator Blutarsky is the John Belushi character. Winds up in control.
For the senior baby boomers that you were talking about when you had the four things, one of, if not the defining moment, was the shooting of JFK. The world changed at that point.
Well, it was and it wasn't. Again, one of the interesting exercises in this book was going back through my own nostalgia and sentimentality and trying to remember how we actually felt at the time, what was actually going on at the time. I did some background reading, but I also did like a lot of soul searching about this. We have a tendency to remember things in kind of the easiest way. And it's not just that we remember only the good things and forget the bad things. That's not it. We can exaggerate both of those things. President Kennedy was, his death was a huge shock to us, of course, because we had grown up in an extremely stable world where we didn't think things like that happened in America. But it was a devastating shock to our parents, to the greatest generation. Much bigger shock. I mean, we're kids. He was an old guy, you know? I mean, he, of course, wasn't, but, I mean, we thought he was. You know, he was an old guy. It was horrible that he got shot, but it was, you know, we'd seen plenty of John Wayne movies. You know, old guys got shot sometimes. And we were crying, but our parents were devastated. And the reason our parents were devastated was because Jack and Jackie Kennedy were them to the most idealized point. They were our moms and dads, but prettier, richer, you know, with more opportunities, with more charm, with, you know, with better elocution, you know, more, you know, they were the perfect versions of our parents. And to see them, to see Jack Kennedy shot for our parents. And so I'm going back and I'm trying to think about that day and when he was shot and about, you know, our shock and you know, school was called off and kids are crying in the hall and so on. But really the most amazing part of that day was the outpouring of emotion from the greatest generation, from our teachers and from our parents. And they were, of course, not a famously emotional generation. They tended to keep the stuff in pretty tight. And to see them so crushed by something like that actually made, I think, on many of us a deeper impression than the assassination itself did. Another, like, not false memory, but another thing that we tend to remember differently than it actually was, something like the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I'm 15 when the Cuban Missile Crisis happens. And we're in biology lab, and I had my biology lab partner was this cute Irish girl, so cute that I had dissected her frog for her, you know, shielding her from the horrors of frog innards, you know, with my madras shirted arm, you know, and cutting up this frog. And so the teacher said, you know, this is so serious. This missile crisis is so serious. This may actually lead to nuclear war. This may lead to destruction. And I think we can't really just have an ordinary class today. You know, we need to talk about this stuff. And so kind of class kind of comes to a halt. And so while he's going on about what a huge crisis this is, I turn over to the Irish girl and I go, you know something? Let's do it. You and me, let's do it. And she looks at me basically like she looked at the frog. And I said, no, honestly, I'm serious. I mean, we may all die in the next couple of days, and we don't want to be dead and never have done it, right? You know? And she said, I'll think about it over the weekend. And over the weekend, the crisis was resolved. You know?
Real quick, we started when we were growing up, maybe five channels. And now we've got 150.
Five, now. God, we have one in Toledo, Ohio.
Well, yeah. We had one channel?
One channel, yes.
I'd love to own that station. Yeah. Anyway, we've gotten to the point now where we have 150 or 300 different channels. And as Bruce Springsteen said, you know, 500 channels, nothing's on. What's happened to TV?
Yeah,
we're the ones
responsible for
what's going on.
Well, I mean, you know, if ever there was a lesson in the difference between quantity and quality, you know, it would be that, you know. And they, sometimes you look at cable television and you think, well, they'll just put anybody on. You know, but no, it's worse than that, you know, because just anybody would be okay, you know. They'll put on is Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. That's not just anybody, you know, that's loads worse than anybody. And so, yeah, and it is, you know, I mean, anybody who's ever, you know, had to entertain a party or friends or a group of people knows it's hard to fill 5 minutes, you know, let alone like 3 million hours a day, you know.
I can't imagine people watching Honey Boo Boo, especially when the Kardashians are on.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, what are they thinking about? Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, our thanks to P.J. O'Rourke for joining us to talk about his new hilarious and insightful book. It is actually very, very funny.
Oh, thank you.
Insightful.
I appreciate
I have to
that.
Think of. Well, at least I got to read it.
There you go.
See, that's what I get for
a
day off.
Thing.
The
yeah.
book is called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and it wasn't my fault, and I'll never do it again. And if you talk real nice to him, he'll sell you a copy and even sign it. Half off for the Vietnam vet, by the way. Let's also thank our audiences here and on radio and TV and the Internet. I'm Ron Owens, and now here comes the fun part. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.